time for Americans to grow up and become financially responsible.
Let's talk about something important.
If you're in it for the money, that's not a bad thing.
Do you realize how much money he just saved us?
This is The Financial Physician with Lou Scatigna.
The Financial Physician. It's the fastest hour in Money Talk Radio.
It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates.
This is financial advice you can take to the bank.
He's your money man.
Show me the money.
Your source for straightforward, no-nonsense financial advice.
Bring me your money questions because I'm here to help.
And now, here he is, the financial physician,
America's money doctor,
Lou Scatigna.
Greetings, my friends. How are you today on this last Sunday of February 2023? Thanks so much for joining us for today's edition of The Financial Physician, where we talk markets, we talk money, markets, politics, and anything that affects your life. And lots to talk about today. There's lots to talk about every day because we're living in times that are moving so quickly that there is not enough time in the radio show, our 2 hours, to even cover it all. So much going on. Love your participation and comments. 732-237-9626 is the call number. How you doing today, Paul?
Doing good, Lou.
Yeah, you and I, Paul and I, we were both looking out the window before because there was the most beautiful sunrise over the Toms River today. And it's one of those sunrises that you actually have to stop and watch it. I mean, I'm doing my show prep here and everything, and I stopped for a good 5-10 minutes just to watch it. It was so beautiful. We got to stop and smell the roses once in a while and enjoy watching a sunrise. There may not be too many more to watch. Paul and I were talking before the show about all the craziness that's going on in the world, and sure enough, we're living in a crazy world. And hour two of our program will concentrate on the madness that is the world in 2023. All right, hopefully you're having a good weekend, or if you're listening to the podcast, hopefully you're having a good day. Thanks so much for joining us. We don't care how you listen to The Financial Physician live, 7 to 9 a.m. right here on 92.7 WOBM here on the Jersey Shore. Or you can listen live anywhere by getting the WOBM app or going to The Financial Physician and click on Listen Live button. So anywhere you have an internet connection or a good cell phone connection, you can listen live to the program or listen to the podcast at thefinancialphysician.com, and the podcast is up right after the program. All right, let's start talking about one of the subjects that are near and dear to my heart, and that is why people fail financially. As a certified financial planner who has been a financial advisor for 40 years, I've come to a very simple conclusion of why the average family fails financially. Why people are now going into retirement with little or no net worth, or even worse, negative net worth because of debt. And it's very simple. It's two things that determine your financial success, your financial health in life, and that is homes and cars. It's that simple. There's no secret to financial success. It's how you manage the purchase of homes and cars. You do that right, the rest falls into place. So let's start with cars today. I'm going to talk about how to buy a car the proper way, the mistakes that people make, and why it drags them down financially and destroys their financial health. It's really quite simple. Next week, we'll talk about homes. We'll talk about, you know, how to determine how much house you could buy and where people make mistakes there, especially now with interest rates so high. It's causing a lot of problems for people who are considering buying a home. But after homes, cars are the most costly item most of us buy. And in the course of our lives, we're going to probably buy 10 to 15 cars. So how we buy these cars and how we finance these cars makes a huge difference in our financial health. Now, years ago, when I was growing up, decades ago, a long time ago, I'm in my 60s, so a long time ago, families had one car, and they kept it until it died of old age. Paul, you remember growing up and seeing people tying up mufflers and stuff like that, jalopies and all that? You don't see that anymore. I haven't seen an old car in a long time, unless it's a classic car at some classic show. Everybody has late model cars. And that's a big problem. I remember when I was growing up in 1966, I was 6 years old. Maybe it was 67. Yeah, 67, I think. I was 7 years old. And my dad bought his first car, at least his first car as an adult since I was born anyway. And he bought a Ford station wagon. I'll never forget it. A green Ford station wagon. And I remember the back seat went all the way down, and it was like flat in the back. And I remember going up to the Catskill Mountains, and we just laid around in the back. There was no seatbelts or anything like that. Who put seatbelts on back then, right? And we would just lay around and play and everything else. Kind of crazy back then. But when I turned 17, so we're talking 10 years later, right? That became my car. My dad had it for a decade. Now, I had it for 2 years. I tricked it up and everything. I put carpet in and everything. It was the babe mobile back in the day. I think I got my wife because of that car, and I always souped it up. But anyway, when my brother turned 17, he got the car, and he had it for a while. It just goes to show you that, you know, people had cars for a long time. You didn't buy cars every 3 years, but that's not the way they do it now. Today, almost every family has more than one car. Why? Because now both spouses work. You got to get to work, right? Well, you got to go. Both spouses have to work to pay for two cars. So what is it? The egg or the chicken? I don't know here. But yeah, that's it. You know, as American standard of living went up, the spouse, there was a necessity for the spouse to go to work. You remember back in the day, right? You know, mom stayed home, reared the kids, dad went to work, and we had a nice middle class lifestyle, right? Well, that started changing back in the late 70s and 80s, maybe even earlier than that, when we were no longer satisfied with comfortable, relatively small homes and one car. We wanted a bigger home. We wanted the in-ground pool. We wanted a beautiful, shiny new car every few years. And to do that, usually the spouse, the wife, had to go to work. And boy, did that have cultural consequences, right? When mom wasn't home, when kids got home from school. That's a whole other subject for another day. But back to cars, I mean, you know, now we buy cars every three years, 4 years, 5 years. We have to have the newest and the best. Now, the problem with cars, it's the only asset we buy knowing it's going to depreciate. It's going to go down in value. It's the opposite of an investment. Any investment we buy, we hope and expect that it's going to grow in value and add to our net worth. Cars are net worth killers because, A, they're so expensive now, and, B, they go down immediately. I call automobiles disinvestments. They're not investments. They're the opposite of investments. They guarantee losses of money. Maybe that's not the right term because they're not really investments. But they steadily drop. Who wants to put $50,000 into something that's going to steadily drop? You wouldn't do that if it was a stock, right? So we have to rethink how we're purchasing cars because cars are depreciating assets. So let's say you bought a car. Right now, the average new car price is about $50,000. I remember in 1979, my father bought a house for $43,000. A Cape Cod and an acre of land, $43,000. That money couldn't even purchase a new car now. Talk about inflation, right? But if you bought a $50,000 car, boy, the salesman's congratulating. You're feeling like $1 million. You should actually be crying. You shouldn't be feeling like $1 million because you actually lost $10,000 the minute you drove it out of the car dealership. That's true. Cars lose about 20% of their value as soon as you take ownership. And then they depreciate anywhere between 6 to 13% a year. So in the first year, on that $50,000 car, you could lose between $13,000 and $16,500. Now, would you buy a stock if it would do that? Of course not. But we're more than happy to buy a car that would do that. And we're going to talk in a minute about that lost first-year depreciation over your lifetime, how it can change your retirement. And it's really quite magical. It's stunning when you do the math. So if you buy 10 cars during your life, let's say the average cost was $40,000 for each car. In first year depreciation alone over your lifetime, you're going to lose between $104,000 and $131,000. That's a lot of money. Now, in my book, I write, and this is one of the most important chapters in my book, is the chapter is titled Wasting Money on a Lifetime of Cars. This chapter and the chapter about homes, most important two chapters in the whole book. Because as I said before, housing and car decisions drive everything. No pun intended. So buying a car guarantees an immediate loss of wealth. And that's not the goal we have in life, right? Our goal is to increase wealth. But the day we go buy a new car, that day we have an immediate loss of wealth. Now, car manufacturers won't like this. But in my book, I write, I'm going to make a bold, true statement. Unless you're wealthy, never buy a new car. Never buy a new car. It'll damage your financial health. And the reason why I say that is, A, new cars are more expensive than used cars, of course. Except for a couple of years ago where used cars were more than new cars. That was an anomaly. But new cars depreciate very fast compared to used cars. Because if you buy a used car, someone already ate that 20% to 25% first year depreciation. So let them take the bath on that, and then you buy it. Buying used cars makes far more sense, especially from a financial point of view, if nothing else. So let's assume, let's go back to our example, that you bought 10 new cars during your lifetime, one every 5 years between the ages of 20 and 70. And let's say the first year depreciation was $10,000 on each car. Now, if you would have took that $10,000 that you lost and put it somewhere where you can earn 5%, at age 75, you would have accumulated $673,000. Wow. Instead of losing $100,000 to $130,000 in first-year depreciation, you would have earned $673,000 for retirement. Boy, when you look at it that way, that's a big deal, right? And we don't think these things through when we go out and buy a new car. We need a car. Let's get a shiny new car. I want all the bells and whistles. And another thing, too. But you see here, you know, people retire. They come to me. They say, Lou, I'm 50-something years old. I'm getting close to retirement. I need to build up some savings. We make good money, but, you know, we just can't seem to save anything. We can't seem to pay down debt. And then I asked them about their cars. It's the first question I asked. Do you have car payments? Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, $400 for my car, $450 for my wife's. And I said, why do you have car payments? Well, I don't have the money to go buy a car. Well, why didn't you buy a used car and just keep it until it dies? Oh, no. I like new cars every few years. And there's another hidden danger that a lot of people get hit with. You know, most people now, when they buy a new car, they put little money down and they finance the rest. It could be like 90 to 100% of the car is financed. So say you bought a car for, I'm looking at the example in my book here, but this was written 12 years ago, so it's a little different. But let's use these numbers. If you buy a car for $30,000 and you put down 10%, you put down $3,000 and you finance the rest. So you're obligated to pay $27,000 plus interest over the term of the loan. So say a month or two later, you're in an accident. You totaled the car. Well, your insurance is only going to pay you what it's worth, which is the depreciated value of the car. Let's say it's $23,000. Which would be the reasonable value for the car at that time. Now, you still owe $27,000 on a loan. So you'd be out $4,000 plus the initial $3,000 down payment. You're down $7,000. Another hit to your net worth. And now you got to go out and buy a new car again. It's amazing how devastating car purchases are to your financial net worth. So what should you do? I'm a big believer in buying late model used cars. Cars that are 2 to 3 years old coming off of lease. These are the best deals you could ever get for a car. And that's the way I've bought my cars most of my adult life. And that's the way I recommend most people buy cars. Because what happens is, you know, when you have a lease on a car, which we'll talk about leases in a little bit, not a smart thing for most people, but say you have a lease on a car and, you know, it's a 2-year lease or a 3-year lease. You turn that car in, time to get a brand new shiny one, right? You know, it's got 25,000 miles on it. I need a new car. So you turn the car in. Well, you know, a bank owns the car. They don't want to hold the car. They want to get their money back. So there's certain dealerships out there that sell cars strictly for banks. And these are called lender liquidators. Right? Their job, the bank hires them, sell the car at book value or less, get us back part of our money, and we could do it again. And locally here, I'll give them a plug, auto lenders. You've heard of auto lenders, right? They have a bunch of dealerships in New Jersey here. One of my favorite dealerships. I love dealing with them, and I'm going to give them a free plug. I probably bought, between me and my kids, my friends, 25 cars there over the years. My clients, my radio listeners, I probably sent over 100 people there. And I've never gotten a complaint. So you walk into this dealership, and they have cars of every make and model. They're usually 2 to 3 years old. They look new, they smell new, and they have roughly 20 to 30,000 miles on it, sometimes even less. Which means they're just broken in now. You know, and nowadays cars are made to last, what, 150, 250,000 miles? How many people buy a car and get its full life use out of it? Hardly anybody these days, right? You lease it, you turn it back in, you buy it after the loan is over, you turn it in to get a new car. I mean, very few people these days are my father, you know, who kept the car from the beginning till it died, in the family at least. So if you buy a 2 or 3 year your car, you're going to buy it about 60-something percent of a brand new car value. And it looks like the new car, it smells like the new car, because what these dealers do, they only keep the cream of the crop. I was talking to one of the managers at Auto Lenders one day, and he told me they get in about 1,500 cars a month that are turned in by leases. They go over each car with a fine-tooth comb, and they only keep about 200 a month. The rest are sent to auction. So these are the beautiful cars. When you walk in the showroom, you would think you're in a new car showroom. You really would. Until you looked at the odometer and see that there's mileage on it. But you can get a really good price on a car. You could finance it. You could lease it. You could do everything you could do with a new car. But you'll pay a fraction of the price for it. And usually there's still a couple of years left on the warranty. So that goes to you. You could buy an extended warranty if you want. They usually will sell you that if that's what you want. Now, let's talk about leasing. Now, a lot of people nowadays, now, the average new car, I said, is $50,000. You put down, I don't know, 10% if you can, and you're going to finance $45,000. That's why. What did I say? I forgot the statistics. I think it was like 15% of car payments now are over $1,000 a month. And that's because of the incredible prices for cars, and people are financing it. Now, you know, with the dealers, like, the dealers know you can't afford it. The dealers know that most people walking in that showroom can't afford the payment over 3 or 4 years on a $50,000 vehicle. So they ask you, what can you afford per month? And then they structure a loan that gets you into that number. Because Americans are stupid. the Americans are financially irresponsible. Americans have feelings of material entitlement, that they deserve to have the best. Right? So they just care about, what's my monthly payment going to be? So they say, well, we can get you down to $350 a month. It's a seven-year loan, though. Okay, that's fine, because I'm going to sell the car. I'm going to turn it in and get a new one in 3 years anyway. I don't care if it's 7 years. But what happens is, when you want to turn it in, you owe more on the car than the car is worth due to depreciation. But that's no problem for the dealer, because the dealer will roll that into the new loan. So now you're underwater on the second loan. You see where this goes? So a lot of people, because of the price of buying a new car, will tend to lease. Lease payments are lower because you don't own the car. You're just renting it. Now, yeah, that may be good because the payments are lower, but over the long term, you never own it. You never have any equity in it. You're limited to the number of miles you can drive. If you go over 12,000 miles or 15, whatever it is, you got to pay a certain amount per mile when you turn that in. And I learned that the hard way early in my life. I had a 12,000 mile lease and I had 18,000 miles on it when I turned it in. It cost me a ton of money. So the best pace, actually the best way to get a car is not even a lender liquidator. You know what the best place to get a car is? Senior retirement communities. Absolutely. You have people, A, who stop driving. Their health doesn't allow them to drive anymore. B, you have estate liquidations. People die, and the estate just wants to get rid of the car and get the money. And these cars are low miles. Grandma just drove it to church. Remember, you know, to church or just to the grocery store. So here you have like a 2015 car with 25,000 miles on it in 2023 that you could buy for $5,000, $6,000, have no payment, and the car will last you 10 or 12 years. Boy, that's a smart way to buy a car. And if you can get into these communities, like many of these are gated communities, you can't get into the clubhouse, but many of them aren't. So if you go into one of these clubhouses in one of these retirement communities, just look at the board, and there's people selling cars. And you can get some of the best deals ever for a car. Best way to buy a car. Second best way, a used car coming off of lease from a lender liquidator. The worst place to buy a used car is a new car dealership. Or even worse, a used car dealership. Because again, you got to understand, the lender liquidators, there's no negotiation. They're selling it at a price that's usually below book value. Whereas a used car dealer or a new car dealer, they're a profit center. They're selling it way above book value. So your best deal is to go to a lender liquidator. And another thing, if you're going to buy from a used car dealer, good luck with that. They could be gone in a minute. And what happens if you get a lemon? You have no recourse. Same is true if you buy a private car. You know, a lot of people sell cars privately. And that may be a good deal for you. You may be able to find a good deal. But make sure you have a mechanic do a thorough check of that car. Because, again, you have no recourse. Once you buy that car, if he's hiding something from you in that car and you find out there's a transmission problem, 3 weeks after you buy it, you're screwed. And there's nothing you can do about it. Now, how do you finance the purchase of a car? That's the second part. All right, we talked about these loans out there that trap you into seven-year loans and everything else. Best way to buy a car is cash, obviously, if you could afford to do so. Whether it's a used car, or whether it's a new car. I say if you can't put down at least 50% on a new car, don't buy it. As I said before, unless you're wealthy, the wealthy can put down cash for a new car or can minimally finance it where they'll never be underwater with it. Okay. Right? My last purchase of a car in 2019 was a new car. I bought a Camry, a new Camry. And it really bugged me because it's against everything I stand for and everything I've written in my book, not to buy a new car. But the used car I wanted, which was a Lexus of some kind, even at the lender liquidators, the price was way too high, in my opinion. It was just outrageous. I said, you know what? I'm not going to buy a luxury car because I don't really care. You know, a lot of people, their car is their ego. You know, that's who they are. Look at me. I want to have that nice Mercedes in the driveway. The BMW, look at this. It's kind of an ego thing. Well, cars have never been an ego thing for me. I just look at my car as get me from point A to point B. Right? I am not my car. I'm other things. But a lot of people, their car is it. They live for their car. My dad was one of them. My father loved a new car every 3 years. I mean, that was what he wanted. Never had any net worth when he retired, but he had his new cars, right? And that goes back to when he, you know, he always used to show me a picture when in 1957, his Cadillac he bought. My dad had a good job before he got married and was making good money, and he was able to afford this Cadillac convertible. And I may be sitting here right now because of that car, because I think he picked up my mother in it. Yeah, he did, actually. In Coney Island, he was driving his car with his friend. And thankfully, you know, my father was kind of quiet, my mother was walking with a friend of hers, and they pulled up next to her and tried to get him to go in the car and take a ride with them. Now, my mother was very prudish, to say the least, and she didn't want to get in the car with boys. But my mother's friend was less prudish, and my father's friend wouldn't take no for an answer. And he got the girls in the car, and they took a ride around Coney Island. And one thing led to another, and I was the firstborn. So I think I'm here because of a car. I didn't even plan that as part of the routine today when I'm talking about cars. But maybe we should buy new cars. It depends on what the car is. Because that was a brand new Cadillac convertible, and I owe my existence to it. But I digress. one of the things here, though, if you can't afford a car with a 4-year loan, don't buy it. That's one of the rules. If you can't put down at least 20% to maintain some equity in it when you drive it out of the showroom, don't buy it. And here's another thing. When you pay off your car, that is not an invitation to turn it in and buy a new one and get a new payment. And that's what Americans do. 4 more months, my car payments are over. I can go buy a new car. How about having some time without a car payment? How about redirecting that money into an IRA account or a college plan or paying down credit cards? You know, we talk about all the time, 67% of Americans are paycheck to paycheck. Why is that? Because they have two car payments of $400 each. I tell you, in the last 15, 20 years, I haven't had a car payment on a car. And that's liberating. That's liberating. Most Americans just believe that, hey, you know, if I'm going to own a car, I'm going to have a car payment. That's just the way it is, right? No. So what's the best way to finance it? Cash is number one. Obviously, if you could buy it, have no car payment, that's great. If a dealer is offering you 0% financing, which there's not too much of that around anymore, but or 1.9%, you're better off taking their money for free and investing your money. You know, say you got $50,000, and you say, you know, I could buy this car for cash, but a dealer's offering you 0% financing. Well, take the financing, take the 50 grand, get 5% on it, right? You're $2,500 ahead a year, $200 a month. So that's a good way. The third way is using a home equity loan. Now, I'm not a big believer in, you know, having a lot of debt on your home. The whole idea is to pay it off. But the equity in your house could be very useful, especially in a short-term manner. So say I'm buying a car. Say it's a used car because that's what I prefer. $25,000. Well, maybe I'm better off getting a 3 or 4% home equity line of credit, paying the car, buying the car with that. Now, I don't have a car payment, but I do have an equity loan payment. But these equity loans are very flexible. Sometimes they allow you to pay just interest. Sometimes you could just pay, well, most of the time, you could pay down chunks of principal at a time. So instead of paying it off over 4 years, maybe you pay it off over 2 years. But the key is keeping the car at that point. If you think about it, 3 years, say you drive 15,000 miles a year. That's 45,000 miles on a car. That's still a relatively new car. Why do you have to turn it in and get a new car payment? Drive it into the ground. Drive it to the point that it's costing you more to repair it than it makes any sense. You know, and you know, if you're not sure, talk to a financial advisor. Now, I always tell my clients this. I say, always call me with, "Hey, Lou, guess what I'm thinking of doing? What do you think?" Don't call me and say, "Lou, guess what I did?" And here's an example. A 50-year-old client of mine, 50-something-year-old, I do his taxes. He's not an investment client of mine. He's not a financial planning client. But I am his accountant. He comes in for taxes, and he shows me a 1099 from his IRA. He took $25,000 out. I said, "What is this? Well, why did you take $25,000 out of your IRA?" "Oh, I wanted to buy a car, and I didn't want to have any car payments." Big mistake. In this case, car payments would have been smarter because, A, he's not 59 and a half, so he's got an immediate 10% penalty of $2,500. And he had to add $25,000 income to $150,000 salary, where he had to pay another 25% or so in federal income tax. So it cost him 35% or almost $10,000 in taxes to get $25,000. That's a stupid way to finance a car. And again, like I said, you know, when people put themselves behind the eight ball with such huge car payments, it doesn't take much. Something happened in your life where you're behind the eight ball where you can't pay those payments anymore. And it's happening right now. Now, supposedly the unemployment rate is at the lowest level in decades. But meanwhile, we see skyrocketing repossessions. Part of that's inflation, where people just can't stay ahead of the game buying groceries and putting gas in that expensive car. But right now, according to Moody's, 9.3% of auto loans are 30 days late. The highest it's been since the financial crisis. And the bulk of these auto loan delinquencies are among subprime borrowers whose credit scores are below 660. And what's going to happen as job losses increase, which they're going to as we enter recession, and these people have this huge debt on these cars. And just, you know, just realize most of these people owe more on the car than they're worth. So you're not going to sell the car. You can't downsize the car. So what do? Here's the keys. Take the car. And that's going to make used car prices, and we're seeing it already, start to come down drastically. You wait 6 months. If you're going to buy a car, my best advice to you is wait 6 months and buy a used car. Because as these repossessions ramp up, the auctions are going to be overwhelmed with sales. Remember markets, right? Economics 101. Demand, supply goes up, prices go down. And supply is rising drastically, and it's going to continue to rise. So make smart decisions on automobiles. A car is just a vehicle to get you to work, to get you to the stores. It's not a status symbol. Although, you know, you watch a football game, and all they're doing is selling your cars and trucks, right? Ram, tough, right? You're going to get the girls. In my father's case, he did. But you are not your car. And people who are financially successful, and I don't care how much money they have, they could be multimillionaires. I know multimillionaires will never buy a new car, right? There was an old book, and I interviewed the author of this book in my first radio show in 1994. I was on WTTM in Trenton. Boy, was I a horrible talk show host. Not that I'm any better now. I'm somewhat better now. But I was horrible back then. And the author of the book, The Millionaire Next Door. Have you heard of that book, The Millionaire Next Door? It's about most millionaires. Now, we're talking 25 years ago. So a millionaire really meant something at that time. Not so much now. But a person with $1 million net worth or more, in his book, is the average millionaire is a person next door that you would never know they're a millionaire because they don't live extravagantly. They don't have brand new luxury cars in their driveway. They have the same car they've been driving for years. They have a modest house. You know, Warren Buffett lives in the same house that he's lived in for 50 years. It's like a small Cape Cod. Worth billions of dollars. He goes, why would I get a new house? He says, it works for me. Those are people who have net worth. Those are the people who retire comfortably. The people who don't blow their money during their earnings years on things like cars and homes. They live properly. And you need to live properly if you want to be the millionaire next door, if you want to have a comfortable retirement. Let's take a break. 732-237-9626 is the call number. My name's Lou Skatigna. You're listening to The Financial Physician. Don't go away. Lou Skatigna here, certified financial planner, president of AFM Investments, and the host of The Financial Physician. Heard every Sunday, 7 to 9 a.m. right here on 92.7 WOBM-FM. Hey, it's that time again, income tax season. There has been many changes to tax rules the last few years. Some deductions have been eliminated and some have been expanded. Avoid IRS headaches by putting my 35 years tax preparation experience to work for you. I guarantee that your return will be accurate and in most cases will be prepared and ready for you in less than 3 business days. This season, I'm taking on a limited number of new tax clients. Call for an appointment today and receive a $100 discount off our already reasonable fee. Tax season does not have to be stressful anymore. Call and lock up your appointment at our downtown Toms River office by calling 732-905-8100. That's 732-905-8100. AFM Investments has been providing financial planning and income tax preparation for over 35 years. Securities transactions through Lee Baldwin & Company, member FINRA, SIPC, registered investment advisory services through Fortitude Advisory Group.
Jersey Shore Septic & Sewer, a family-owned and operated premier septic installation and repair company with more than a decade of experience in the septic services. Jersey Shore Septic & Sewer provides full-service maintenance and cleaning services, pumping septic tanks, repairing broken sewer lines, cleaning of grease tanks for restaurants, as well as real estate septic inspections, repairs, and installations. Phone 732-600-8721 or go to jerseyshoreseptic.com to learn more. Jersey Shore Septic and Sewer. Top quality work at the most affordable rates.
Do you have a home to sell? Do you need to buy a home? Or maybe you would like to consider a career in real estate? Well, you need to contact my brother, Mark Skatigna. He's the broker manager of Coldwell Banker Flanagan Realty on Route 70 in Manchester. Mark has helped so many of my clients with either the sale of their home or to purchase a new home. All of them could not have been happier with his help. What about an exciting new career in real estate? Maybe you're finding you have more time on your hands than you would like to after retiring from your full-time job and are also looking to make some extra income. With flexible hours to still enjoy your free time and income that could be limitless, Mark could train you to be as successful as you would like to be and enjoy a rewarding career in real estate. For help with any of your real estate needs, as well as any information on a career in real estate, call my brother Mark Skatigna at Coldwell Banker Flanagan Realty. His number is 732-657-6200. That's 732-657-6200. Mark Skatigna, Coldwell Banker Flanagan Realty. Give him a call. You'll be happy you did.
I'm Lou Skatigna, certified financial planner, author, president of AFM Investments, and the host of The Financial Physician, heard each Sunday morning, 7 to 9, right here on 92.7 WOBM, or anytime at thefinancialphysician.com. Don't let interest rates, inflation, and market volatility keep you awake at night. Come to my Toms River office for a no-obligation professional diagnosis of your financial health. I'll review your investments, income taxes, and retirement plan. I'll suggest a comprehensive financial and estate plan that will improve your financial health and, most importantly, lower your financial risk during these uncertain times. If you are retired or plan to retire, I will show you strategies designed to increase your income and protect your estate from nursing home costs. Call us at 732-905-8100 and get on the road to a healthy financial future. That's 732-905-8100. Join me Sunday morning, 7 to 9, for The Financial Physician right here on 92.7 WOBM or listen to the podcast at thefinancialphysician.com. Securities transactions through Lee Baldwin & Company, member FINRA, SIPC, registered investment advisory service through Fortitude Advisory Group.
Call the financial physician now at 732-237-9626. Here's Lou Scatigna.
All right, welcome back to the Financial Physician, where we get together each and every Sunday live right here on 92.7 WOBM, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. again every Sunday morning or anytime at the podcast at thefinancialphysician.com. And so many of our listeners are podcast listeners, and we don't care when or how you listen to the program, either live or at the podcast at thefinancialphysician.com. Paul will have it uploaded right after the show's over. I mean, literally 10 minutes after the show's over, the podcast is available a little after 9 Eastern time here on Sunday mornings, and you can listen to the show anytime you want at thefinancialphysician.com. We appreciate you sharing the link with friends and family, putting it on social media or any website you feel would benefit by having a link to the show. So that helps us grow. Really do appreciate that. That's thefinancialphysician.com. And love your emails. Get a lot of emails from our listeners with personal finance questions, comments about things I've talked about on the show or things they want me to talk about. Love your emails. I answer each and every one. My email is lou@thefinancialphysician.com. Very simple. lou@thefinancialphysician.com. All right. When somebody very close to us dies, and we've all experienced this. I mean, obviously, there's a tremendous emotional toll when we lose somebody that we love, that we're close to. But when someone dies, there's a lot of things we got to do. And people are overwhelmed by it. I assist families in dealing with how to settle an estate. And even if you're married, you know, you still have so many things to do. And people are overwhelmed by it. You know, you have to do things when you're least capable of doing them, mainly when you're emotional wreck, pretty much. So I came across a checklist. Kiplinger had this out, and I thought this was very good, and I wanted to share it with you of the things that you need to do, whether you want to do them at that time or not. Some things you just can't wait. And the first thing is to obviously contact a funeral home and make arrangements. This is where, you know, if you could pre-plan your own funeral, it's the biggest gift you can give somebody in your family. So they don't have to go and make these decisions on what coffin to pick and how much money to spend on this. And, you know, not to mention when you plan your own funeral, it's exactly the way you want it. It's at the funeral home you want it. You choose your own casket or your method of burial, what music you want played, what pictures you want there. But the majority of people, you know, I remember the day my dad died, he died 4 a.m. on the 4th of July. That afternoon, I was in the funeral home making plans for his funeral. And that was the last thing I wanted to do on that day. You know, I didn't want to have to leave my home and go to a funeral place and plan my dad's funeral. I mean, I wanted a couple of days just to deal with it. Now, it wasn't sudden. We knew what was coming, so it wasn't like a sudden death, which makes it even more difficult. But when you plan a funeral, make sure that, you know, that's where you're going to get death certificates. It comes from the funeral home. Make sure you get at least 6, maybe 10, because that's the average you're going to need. So ask the funeral director to give you, I would say, 10. And make your funeral arrangements and then go through the funeral. Don't do anything else. That's the most important thing that you need to do, obviously, the first thing you need to do. Mourn the loss of your loved one. Go through the funeral. Bury them. And then think about the other things you need to do. Now, you may have to call an attorney, depending on how complicated the estate are. There's a lot of legal matters sometimes that have to be addressed. If you have a financial advisor, or they had a financial advisor, contact them, because they're very good. A good financial advisor, especially one that deals with older clients like myself, we're very good at directing you through the process. I almost always, with my clients, direct them through the process. I let them know. I mean, you know, except for clients that die suddenly. But when my clients are in decline, especially if they're a widow or widower, you know, we're dealing with a lot of this stuff beforehand. We're dealing with the family. We're meeting with them. We're making generational wealth transfer issues, dealing with that. We're dealing with long-term care issues. We're making sure that the will and beneficiaries are all right. But somebody who deals with older clients is very good. A good certified financial planner or attorney is very good at walking you through that. And I tell my clients, the first thing you do, your family, is call me. All right? I'm going to get you a tax ID number for the estate. I'm going to tell you how to probate the will. I'm going to tell you the order that we need to do everything. And many times I do this without charge. I mean, it's just the way I honor my client that's been with me for 25 years or any client is to help their family transition to post-parent, usually parent, situation. Another thing you need to do is contact Social Security Administration. All right. Now, your benefits may change after a spouse's passing. It happens a lot of times. Like, many times, one spouse gets less Social Security than the spouse that passed. Well, when your spouse passes, you're going to get the higher of the two. You got to notify Social Security. A, you got to notify them to stop sending payments to the deceased and then talk to them about what's your best move. Next thing you got to do, and you may not think about this, is contact all three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, and notify them of the death. Now, Social Security will eventually notify these agencies, but it could take several months. So it doesn't hurt to make a phone call and let them know that they died. Cancel their health insurance. Now, if it's being provided by a union or a past employer or a government, you got to contact them. Let them know that they passed. If your spouse is getting a pension, you got to contact the company. Now, you may be eligible to receive benefits if there are survivor options there as well. Sometimes there's a lump sum. Sometimes there's insurance, life insurance at a company that you may not be aware of when someone passes. So contact the company that your spouse or the union that your spouse worked for or your parent. Notify any life insurance companies and file a claim. And this is typically a very easy process. And you don't want to put this off for later. You want to do it right away. Because the sooner you get the funds, the sooner you'll be able to pay estate expenses and things like that. So it happens really quick. You just call the insurance company. You notify them of their passing. You provide them with a death certificate. And they'll send and the beneficiary gets the money. If your spouse was a veteran, contact the Department of Veterans Affairs and let them know. Maybe there's some benefits payable to you. Now, all this stuff comes down to knowledge. I mean, you have to know that your mother or father have a life insurance policy at the company they work for. You have to know, well, what life insurance policies do you have? And where are the policies? It's amazing how many people die. And their family doesn't know they have life insurance because the policy's buried somewhere. Or they lost the policy years ago. You may be talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. Your family's got to know this stuff. Next, you got to notify banks, credit card companies, mortgage companies, insurance companies. Any important bill-related companies where they get bills every month. There may be accounts that need to be changed into your name if you're a spouse. Now there's two different issues here. There's an issue when you're a spouse and there's an issue when, you know, there's no spouse there. I mean, when you have a spouse, these things are relatively easy. Most assets are jointly held. Many times a will doesn't need to be probated because everything is jointly held. You know, you still have the same bills and everything else. You're not going to sell the house. I mean, there's a lot of different things there that go when you're married. It's when you're single, it's very important that your next of kin know all this stuff. And that's why the estate letter of instruction, which I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, is so important because you list all these things there and you give it to a loved one. It's a roadmap to this checklist to get these things done. And many of you emailed me and requested it. I got a PDF file. I'd be more than happy to email it to you, the estate letter of instructions. If you're an older person, especially if you're single, you need to have that. And your family needs to have that, and they need to know where it is. It's as important a document as your will and your living will and your power of attorney. You need to have the estate letter of instruction. It has all the stuff there. Another thing you're going to want to do is contact your accountant to discuss how your tax issues are going to change. And there are. Say you're married, filing jointly. You have a $27,000 standard deduction. Well, now you're single. That cuts in half. How's that going to affect your taxes? How is your income going to change? Is a pension going to change? Is it going to be less Social Security coming in? You know, what's your tax situation going to look like as a single person going forward? And in many cases, it changes drastically, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad. Next thing you want to going to do, this is something that we could do now. You don't have to wait for somebody to die to do this. Complete an unclaimed property search. You know how much money is sitting in different accounts around the country or has been escheated back to the state? Now, an old bank account you had when you were a kid that had 80 bucks in it, and now it's worth $6,000, you know, with interest over 40 years, right? There's a great website that you can go to. It's called missingmoney.com. Missing money. Go there. This is set up by the states because the states ultimately get this money. After about 3 years, it's escheated. It's called escheat. It starts with an E, escheated, back to the state. Now, you can always get it back, but you have to claim it. So I did this week to myself. I went to missingmoney.com, put my name, all the information in, and believe it or not, there's an account in my name somewhere that has some money in it. So I clicked on that button to claim it. It went to the state. I got an email from the state saying they're looking into it and they're going to provide me with details. I also saw my mother and father's name on that list. And they're both deceased, but they still have an estate. So I claimed that too. And I'll be interested to see, you know, what it is. Now, many times it may be minuscule amount of money. But even if it's 100 bucks, I want it. I want to go out to dinner with my wife or my dad. Or based on my childhood bank account. So I suggest everybody do that. Go to missingmoney.com, put your information in. It's going to ask for your Social Security number. Now, I was a little nervous about doing that, but the more I looked into it, I researched it. This is run by the state. It's very secure. It's the same as filing a tax return. It's safe, at least as safe as anything is going to be. But do it. Go to missingmoney.com, put your name, put all your information in. And more often than not, I did it to friends of mine. I kept putting their name in, and they were all coming up with something. So I bet the majority of us have some unclaimed property somewhere. All right, going back to what we do when someone dies. Update your own estate plan. Again, this is true if you're a spouse. This is very important. You know, maybe your will needs to be redone. Now that your spouse is dead. Now, if you did your will properly and it's relatively contemporary, you probably put in there, if my spouse predeceases me, then my children share equally my residual estate. Or if my spouse is the executor and he passes away and predeceases me, my son Joe is my executor. If that's the case in your will, you don't need to change it. And if you're satisfied with what the will says, but make sure you understand that. Maybe your spouse was a power of attorney for you, or maybe now you need to name a child. And, you know, I did a segment on managing your estate planning about a month ago, and it's very important that you review your estate plan as a single person because now you have generational wealth transfer. Spousal wealth transfer is nothing. It's usually with ease. My wife's the beneficiary of my IRA. Our accounts are jointly held. The house is in both your names. The surviving spouse gets it with little effort. But when mom's alone and there's no more dad,
Well, when she dies, it goes to the next generation. That's when estate planning has to be done and has to be done properly. You have to contact the financial advisor. Any investment companies, say they have accounts at Vanguard, they manage their own money. Well, you got to contact all these accounts and make sure they're retitled based on what the will says. Or if you're a joint owner on that account, you have to have that spouse removed from the account. Maybe you have to change beneficiaries on IRAs now. You inherit your husband's IRA. You have an IRA yourself. And you named each other as beneficiaries. Now you got to change that beneficiary to your children. Boy, this is where you drop the ball a lot. And I've dealt with this many times. A client of mine died 7 years ago, and nobody notified us. Nobody notified us. They had an IRA with me. Their spouse was the beneficiary. Now, Eileen learned that the husband had died after the wife had died. I got a call from the children saying the wife had died. I said, well, you know, your father is the beneficiary of her IRA. Oh, dad died 7 years ago. Uh-oh. Now what do? We have no beneficiary now. And what a nightmare it was to get this fixed where the kids got the money. I mean, it was paperwork that you wouldn't believe. And it fell on me mostly, but anyway, make sure you change your beneficiaries on your life insurance policies, your pensions, your 401k, your IRA accounts, your annuities. And prepare to probate the estate. What does that mean, probating estate? That's when the executor named in the will takes the will and their death certificate and goes to the surrogate court in the county that person died in. So if you die here in Toms River, you're going to go to the Ocean County Surrogates Court on Washington Street in Toms River. You don't need an appointment. You just walk in with the will, the death certificate, and you walk out with a letter naming you the executor. And then you can take care of business. The next thing you need to do is get a tax ID number for the estate. Now, your accountant should help you with this. I do it for my clients all the time. I go on the IRS website, put in all the information about the deceased, all the information about the executor, and I print out a letter that gives a tax ID number for the estate. Because you got to understand, when a person dies, they cease to exist as a financial entity. Their Social Security number means nothing. Any existing powers of attorney mean nothing. Now the estate is its own entity, so it has its own tax ID number. It has its own checking account, which is the next thing that the executor does, is open up a checking account at a bank, the estate of John Doe, Joe Doe, executor. And when you liquidate assets, you know, all those assets are moved to the estate account. If you have an investment account, the broker is going to open up an estate account, the estate of John Doe, Joe Doe, executor. And then you have the right to liquidate things and then have money sent to that checking account, at which point you would distribute it to the beneficiaries. Now, those are the things that you need to do, the basic checklist of things you need to know. It's quite long, right? And it's quite, you know, burdensome. But things that you shouldn't do when someone dies, don't make any big decisions that you're not required to make about selling the house or giving money away. Don't make major purchases. Don't give stuff away. Take your time. Deal with the grief of losing your loved one. Deal with the immediate financial issues that you have to deal with that I just laid out to you. And don't make anything, any decisions. Don't make investment decisions. You know, there's people that prey on widows. They look at the obituaries and they find out that a guy died survived by his wife. And they track you down. And they look to try to sell you annuities, investments, or scam you. Be very, very careful. Do not make any decisions when you're not prepared to do so. So again, emotional toll when we lose somebody. And unfortunately, we're thrust into making all these moves that we have to make, and decision making has to be done. Hopefully you have a trusted advisor to walk you through that. And if you're not up to it and you're not qualified to do it,
bring in a family member or somebody to take care of all these things, because you can't, you just can't let them slide. All right, top of the hour, 732-237-9626 is the call number here at the Financial Physician. Don't go away. It's time for Americans to grow up and become financially responsible.
Let's talk about something important.
If you're in it for the money, that's not a bad thing.
Do you realize how much money he just saved us?
This is The Financial Physician with Lou Scatigna.
The Financial Physician. It's the fastest hour in money talk radio.
It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates.
This is financial advice you can take to the bank.
He's your money man.
Show me the money.
Your source for straightforward, no-nonsense financial advice.
Bring me your money questions, because I'm here to help.
And now, here he is, the Financial Physician,
America's Money Doctor, Lou Scatigna.
All right, welcome to hour two of our program called The Financial Physician. Lou Scatigna here, certified financial planner and your money doctor. Live each and every Sunday, 7 to 9 a.m. right here on 92.7 WOBM, or anytime at thefinancialphysician.com, where we have the podcast of the program. So if you're just getting up or just coming out of church, or just stumbled upon the program and you want to listen to the entire 2 hours, go to thefinancialphysician.com and just click on the radio tab, and you could listen to the latest Financial Physician radio program. You could download it, or you could just play it on the website there. That's thefinancialphysician.com. Let's talk financial markets. Up until this past week, 2023 has been a real great year for the stock market, after one of the worst years in history for stocks and bonds in 2022. We had a nice rebound in January into the beginning of February. But this week we saw, the last couple of weeks we've been seeing the markets roll over. And the markets had a pretty dreadful week this past week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 3% for the week. Now it's given up all its gains for the year, and now the Dow is down 1% for the year. The S&P 500 fared a little better, down 2.7%. Still up 3.4% for the week, for the year, I'm sorry. The NASDAQ was down. The NASDAQ goes up more than all the other indexes when the markets are going up, and it goes down more than the other indexes when the markets are going down. The NASDAQ was down 3.3% for the week, but still up 8.87%. Now, the NASDAQ was up over 12% a couple of weeks ago, so it's given it back. And my guess is that the markets are now due for a major, major downturn. And one of the reasons I say that is the bond market. We're starting to see interest rates move up quite dramatically in the bond market, which when yields are going up, the stock markets go down. The yield on a 10-year treasury now is 3.95%, up from 3.8% a week ago. And my guess is we're going to go over 4% this week, and we may start seeing new highs in yields on a 10-year treasury. Why is that such a big deal? Because, A, it affects almost everything else as far as interest rates go, namely mortgage rates, which we'll talk about in a second. They track the 10-year. And other interest rates in the economy track the 10-year. So when you see interest rates going up in a 10-year treasury bond, that's very, very bad for housing, and it's bad for interest rates we pay on car loans, like we talked about in the first segment, credit cards, and everything else. So at 3.95, we're almost at 4%. You know, you got to recall, I mean, a year ago, we were under 1%. On a 10-year treasury. We're at 4 now, basically. Now, if you look at lower maturities, they're even higher. The 2-year treasury is 4.81. And a lot of times when we look at bond yields, geeks like me and people in the financial press and whatnot, we look at the 2-year and we look at the 10-year and we compare the rates. Now, usually the 2-year is much lower in interest than the 10-year. That's a normal yield curve. Normally, the longer you lock up your money, the
the more yield you get, right? For those of you who don't not familiar with bonds, just think about CDs, right? You get a five-year CD, you're going to get a higher interest rate than a one-year CD. Well, that's not always true in the bond market. Right now, we have short-term yields higher than long-term yields. That's called the inverted yield curve. It almost always portends a recession. Let's put it this way. Every recession that's ever occurred, there was an inverted yield curve first. Take the one-year U.S. Treasury, 5.06. So you go out and you buy a one-year Treasury, you're going to get 5% on your money compared to 3.95 on the 10-year. So this is a pretty steep inverted yield curve. And the steeper the yield curve inverted, the worse the recession is going to be. And the markets are starting to see this now. And why is the yield going up in the 10-year? Because inflation is stubbornly high. And it looks like the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise interest rates, and maybe even more dramatically than the markets thought. And rising interest rates are very negative for markets, very negative for the economy, very negative for housing. The 30-year fixed rate mortgage on average is 6.88% right now. A couple of weeks ago, it was 6.3. Actually, a few weeks ago, it was 6.15. And now we're almost at 7% again. My guess is maybe as early as next week, we'll be over 7 again. At a time when the housing market is starting to plummet. Certainly, home sales are crashing. And if you're a purchaser of a home right now, you're not happy with what mortgage rates are looking like. If you're a real estate agent, you're not happy. If you're a mortgage broker and you see these rates going up, you're not happy because it's going to affect your business. You know, it's quite interesting when you think about it. The Federal Reserve caused the inflation through the printing of money, the quantitative easing, the purchasing of bonds, the suppressing of interest rates, the zero interest rate policy for so long. They caused the inflation, number one. And now inflation hurts middle and lower income Americans the most. Those on the margins, right? You know, that living paycheck to paycheck. If you think you're living paycheck to paycheck and things become more expensive, it hurts. You start doing away with stuff. There was a recent survey, a Morning Consult survey, that said that over 40% of U.S. consumers are eating out less. You want to talk about how economies flow? You know what that means. Wait staff earn less tips. Restaurants make less money. You know, it all flows through the economy. But what my point is the Federal Reserve, which should be a bit disbanded, by the way, they cause the inflation that's harming American families right now. Then they cause interest rates to go very high, which hurts families even more. So it's a 1-2 punch. Let's cause the problem and hurt the American middle class and lower income. And then let's make the problem even worse by throwing high interest rates on top of them, where credit card rates are at all-time highs, where people can't afford a house. Can't afford car payments. Boy, the Federal Reserve is doing really good by the middle and lower class, aren't they? Anyway. Oil prices down for the week, $76.45 a barrel. With that, we're seeing gasoline prices down. It's all over the place. I'm seeing as high as $3.37, and Paul said, what do you say, $3.10, $3.12, $3.15? $3.11,
yeah.
$3.11. So it depends where you go. I think shopping around a little bit now is probably smart if you're filling up your tank. Probably a good idea to get a Costco card, get gas there. The rising yields and stronger dollar adversely affecting precious metals, temporarily at least. Gold closed at $1,820 an ounce. Not long ago, it was $1,950. The correction in gold. Silver, which was recently $24, down to $20.76. Again, I think these are temporary declines. I think we're going to see significant increases later in the year in gold and silver. Bitcoin, 22,900, hit 25,000 earlier in the week, so a little bit of a decline. in Bitcoin. So the markets are overturning right now. There's no question that interest rates are going higher, and I think they're going to stay higher for longer than most people think. I think the stock market right now is an accident waiting to happen. I really do. Because the economy is starting to crash now, even faster than a lot of experts expected. A lot of people are saying that, you know, we're going towards an economic crisis, maybe worse than 2008. And I believe it's here now. I mean, you just haven't really seen it full blown yet. But if you look at some of the economic stuff that's coming out, I mean, it's really, really negative. On Tuesday, we learned that existing home sales in the United States have now fallen for 12 months in a row. Why? High mortgage rates. Of course. Not to mention the price of homes, which is still stubbornly high. Sales of previously owned homes tumbled 0.7% in January from the prior month to an annual rate of 4 million units, according to the National Association of Realtors. On an annual basis, existing home sales are now down 37% when compared with January of 2021. Do you realize how big a decline that is in housing? You don't see that. It's the slowest pace since November 2010, when we were still in the throes of the housing crisis back then. So think about these numbers for a minute. Existing home sales have dropped every single month for an entire year. That's pretty catastrophic, if you ask me. And existing home sales are down 37% lower than they were at this time last year. And again, we haven't seen anything like this since the housing crash. And we really haven't seen the decline in prices that are coming yet. They're lagging still. Now, we're also seeing major issues in commercial real estate. Last week, this giant investment manager at Brookfield Asset Management defaulted on a total of $750 million in debt for a pair of 52-story towers in Los Angeles. And this is happening in New York. It's happening everywhere else. Why? Because these places are empty. You know, people are still working from home. They're not going back to the city. A, they like working at home. So they're really pressuring their employers not to make them come in. And B, they're afraid of getting killed by going into New York City, Chicago, Philadelphia to go to work. As these places have become crime-ridden hellholes. So all this real estate is empty. And you can see a lot of these defaults, which ultimately comes down to the banking system. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm telling you, this commercial real estate thing is going to be big. The leading economic indicators, which is exactly what it says. These are indicators that are leading the economy. So if you look at the leading economic indicators, it tells you where the economy is going. The leading economic indicator dropped lower in each of the past 10 months. 10 months in a row they're dropping. You don't see that very often. Last week, Walmart and Home Depot came out and said there's a very challenging economic environment out there. And they had bleak forecasts. And that's one of the reasons why you saw a 3% decline in the market last week, is these biggies, Walmart and Home Depot, coming out and saying, sales aren't so good. And looking forward, looks horrible. And when you hear companies like Walmart, you know, these are, you know, low-income people shop there. They're cutting back. Home Depot, I guess people aren't spending money on their homes now. bad economy coming. Also, we're seeing major retailers are closing hundreds of locations all over the country. In this article, it says, America is bracing for mass exodus of retail stores across the nation this year, with more than 800 big box locations set to close from California to New York. Among the iconic names to announce their downsizing include Bed Bath & Beyond, Walmart, Gap, and Party City. At least 803 stores are set to be shuttered over the rest of 2023. And there's going to be more, a lot more. And even though the fudged economic job numbers and look like you have a strong labor market. We don't. All you hear every week is many, many companies announcing layoffs. And they can only lie to us so long with all these companies laying off thousands and thousands of people. And again, the worst hasn't hit yet. Many more people are going to lose their jobs in the months ahead. And that's scary, given the inflation we're living with, given that 67% of Americans are paycheck to paycheck. What happens when the paycheck disappears? How are these people going to get by? That's why you're going to see massive foreclosures on homes. We're going to see massive repossessions. We're seeing it already in cars. We're seeing incredible demand at food banks. It's very sad what's happening. We got interest rates that are sky high and probably going higher. We got inflation out of control. And we have lack of leadership. So the day of reckoning is finally arriving. When you have a debt-laden society that we have right now, you were in trouble. And the economy is so reliant on debt right now. I mean, people are using credit cards to eat, to go grocery shopping. I mean, household debt rose almost $400 billion in the fourth quarter last year alone. $400 billion. It's not a sign of a healthy economy. Here's another example I came across this week that illustrates how reliant the U.S. economy is on debt. I bought a gift basket of cheese and, you know, for Christmas for somebody from Wisconsin Cheeseman. So I get their catalog in the mail. So I got their catalog in the mail. And now they're selling gift packs of cheese and salamis and candies and stuff on credit. Here's their ad. Buy now, pay later from $10 a month. So if you buy a $50 gift basket, you could pay it off over 5 months. What is it next? Is it going to be a loaf of bread? You could pay the grocery store over a few weeks? It's unbelievable. And of course, you're going to pay interest on that. You'll be paying for cheese for months. It's just crazy. And it encourages, you know, consumers to spend more. You know, whenever you get these, you know, well, you don't have to pay for it all now. Just like a car, like we talked about earlier. You could pay for it over 7 years. So, you know, you watch CNBC and Fox Business, and you get these pundits that come out and tell you the economy's strong. But it's all a facade because it's all a house of cards because it's all based on debt. If you're in the stock market, boy, you took a big hit last year. You had a nice little bump in the first 6 weeks of this year. I'm hoping a lot of you learned your lesson and took some money out of the market and put yourself in a more conservative posture because I think that we're going to see I think 2023 is going to make 2022 look like a walk in the park as far as returns in the stock market go. I really do. And it's not too late to lower your exposure. And people have no idea. It just blows my mind how ignorant people are at the risk in their 401ks. I had a person in my office this week. Lou, I want to transfer my IRA to you. Okay. Let me see the statement. It was at Wells Fargo, and they had $60,000 in it in the beginning of 2022. Now they have 47. Right? They're a few years away from retirement. I said, why didn't you come to me last year? We would have had you out of the market. We would have had you safely tucked away in guaranteed investments. But it was too late. Well, it's not too late. I mean, we've protected them. We had them sell out on early last week, really before the market really tanked. And we're going to put them in a more conservative posture. Now, the damage, again, is somewhat done. But at least they're stopping the bleeding. I'm telling you, listen to me. If you got a lot of money in the market, you really need to think about lowering that risk. All right. It's tax season right now. There's two different types of people out there that I deal with all the time. People who like to file early and people who like to file last minute. What is better? Well, filing early for most people is better. Number one, if you get a refund, you get it faster. And nowadays, who doesn't need a tax refund to help buy groceries, right, and everything else, or maybe pay down some debt? And now, thankfully, you know, 8 out of 10 Americans get a direct deposit of their tax refund now versus waiting to get a check in the mail. So now I'm seeing people are getting their tax refunds in 2-3 weeks the most after they e-file it. So, you know, if you usually get a refund and you have all your stuff together, why would you wait? Now, sometimes it makes sense to file later. Maybe you need to wait a little while longer to get all your documents. Some documents come late. Say you have partnerships or you get a K-1, which you may not get till March. The last thing you want to do is file your income taxes have to refile them and amend them because you got something else in the mail. That happens to me all the time. Clients come in, we do their taxes, and then they call me in March. Oh, Lou, I just got this in the mail. Which doesn't make them happy and doesn't make me happy. Because now I got to file an amended return in the middle of tax season. So make sure you have everything. You know, if you usually get stuff that are late, like take brokerage statements, brokerage 1099s, they don't come. They're not mailed out till February 15th. So many people are just getting them now. So if you went to an accountant and you thought you had everything, but you didn't get your brokerage 1099 and now you got it, well, it changes everything on your tax return. And now your accountant will have to amend the return. Some people wait because they're trying to decide whether or not they'll have enough money to make an IRA contribution because you have till April filing deadline to make your contribution for the prior year and get a deduction for it. So a lot of people tell me, Lou, I don't want to file yet because I'm trying to save up as much as I can to make an IRA contribution and I don't know what that number will be yet. That's fine. But we have people, they file all the way. Some file early, some file late, some file in the middle. And I guess that's a good thing for me as an accountant and all my other friends who are accountants. So you know when I'm all coming in the same week. That's not going to work. So it's good that people come in all different times. Most importantly, don't miss the tax deadline. You could file an extension that'll extend your taxes to October 15th. But just remember, it's not an extension to pay. A lot of people tell me, Lou, I can't pay these taxes. File an extension for me. No, it's not going to change anything. You're going to owe penalties and you're going to owe interest and everything else when you file later on. Now, if you're not ready to file because you don't have all your documents or whatever, then at least make an estimated tax payment work with your accountant to try to estimate what you're going to owe so you don't hit those penalties. Filing deadline this year is April 18th. It's usually the 15th. 15th is a Saturday in Washington, D.C. on Monday. The 17th is Emancipation Day, so they give you an extra day. Filing deadline this year is April 18th. Let's take another short break. 732-237-9626 is our call number. My name's Lou Skatigna. Don't go away. Lou Skatigna here, certified financial planner, president of AFM Investments, and the host of The Financial Physician. Heard every Sunday, 7 to 9 a.m. right here on 92.7 WOBM FM.
Hey, it's that time again, income tax season. There has been many changes to tax rules the last few years. Some deductions have been eliminated and some have been expanded. Avoid IRS headaches by putting my 35 years tax preparation experience to work for you. I guarantee that your return will be accurate and in most cases will be prepared and ready for you in less than 3 business days. This season, I'm taking on a limited number of new tax clients. Call for an appointment today and receive a $100 discount off our already reasonable fee. Tax season does not have to be stressful anymore. Call and lock up your appointment at our downtown Toms River office by calling 732-905-8100. That's 732-905-8100. AFM Investments has been providing financial planning and income tax preparation for over 35 years. Securities transactions through Lee Baldwin and Company, member FINRA, NSIPC, Registered Investment Advisory Services through Fortitude Advisory Group.
Jersey Shore Septic and Sewer, a family-owned and operated premier septic installation and repair company with more than a decade of experience in the septic services. Jersey Shore Septic and Sewer provides full-service maintenance and cleaning services, pumping septic tanks, repairing broken sewer lines, cleaning of grease tanks for restaurants, as well as real estate septic inspections, repairs, and installations. Phone 732-600-8721 or go to jerseyshoreseptic.com to learn more. Jersey Shore Septic and Sewer, top quality work at the most affordable rates.
Do you have a home to sell? Do you need to buy a home? Or maybe you would like to consider a career in real estate? Well, you need to contact my brother, Mark Skatigna. He's the broker manager of Coldwell Banker Flanagan Realty on Route 70 in Manchester. Mark has helped so many of my clients with either the sale of their home or to purchase a new home. All of them could not have been happier with his help. What about an exciting new career in real estate? Maybe you're finding you have more time on your hands than you would like to after retiring from your full-time job and are also looking to make some extra income. With flexible hours to still enjoy your free time and income that could be limitless, Mark could train you to be as successful as you would like to be and enjoy a rewarding career in real estate. For help with any of your real estate needs, as well as any information on a career in real estate, call my brother Mark Skatigna at Coldwell Banker Flanagan Realty. His number is 732-657-6200. That's 732-657-6200. Mark Skatigna, Coldwell Banker Flanagan Realty. Give him a call. You'll be happy you did.
I'm Lou Skatigna, certified financial planner, author, president of AFM Investments, and the host of The Financial Physician, heard each Sunday morning 7 to 9 right here on 92.7 WOBM or anytime at thefinancialphysician.com. Don't let interest rates, inflation, and market volatility keep you awake at night. Come to my Toms River office for a no-obligation professional diagnosis of your financial health. I'll review your investments, income taxes, and retirement plan. I'll suggest a comprehensive financial and estate plan that will improve your financial health and, most importantly, lower your financial risk during these uncertain times. If you are retired or plan to retire, I will show you strategies designed to increase your income and protect your estate from nursing home costs. Call us at 732-905-8100 and get on the road to a healthy financial future. That's 732-905-8100. Join me Sunday morning, 7 to 9 for The Financial Physician right here on 92.7 WOBM or listen to the podcast at thefinancialphysician.com. Securities transactions through Lee Baldwin and Company, member of FINRA and SIPC, Registered Investment Advisory Service through Fortitude Advisory Group.
Call the Financial Physician now at 732-237-9626. Here's Lou Skatigna.
All right, just a reminder about the website, thefinancialphysician.com, where the podcast is available right after the program. No reason to miss any of our two-hour program each and every week here on The Financial Physician, thefinancialphysician.com. Just go to the radio tab and click on listen to the latest program. Also love your emails, Lou at thefinancialphysician.com. All right, we have a half hour left. It goes so fast here on The Financial Physician. I can't believe where we are. Anyway, prepare to be outraged this half hour. I saved the outrageous stuff for last, and I could probably do 2 hours of outrage. But let's start off with this. How about this headline? The IRS is developing a new Biden-backed algorithm that'll see more white and Asian people targeted for tax audits to boost racial equity. Now, you got to understand, there's a difference between the word equity and equality. All right? They want you to believe it's the same thing. It's not. Equality means equitable opportunities for people. Everybody has the same opportunity to rent a house, to get a job, whatever, regardless of their skin color or their sexual persuasion or whatever. Equity means everybody on the same level. Okay, that's the difference. All right. Equity and equitable is not the same thing. So Joe Biden, you probably didn't hear about this. Paul, you're pretty informed. So if you didn't hear about this, then probably a lot of people.
Yeah, I didn't hear about that one.
All right. Well, it's more general than that. Biden this week signed an executive order on further advancing racial equity and support for underserved communities through the federal government. Now, it doesn't specifically mention audits, but what it mentions is that every agency of the federal government now have to change their practices and make them more equitable to underserved communities. Specifically, the order directs agencies to prevent and remedy discrimination, including by protecting the public from algorithmic discrimination. Now, America's First Legal Foundation is now investigating how that could affect the IRS. And it wants internal documents about equity. And what they're saying now, based on this executive order, well, the IRS is an agency of the federal government. They have to look at equity and how they audit. Because apparently, it seems that the IRS audits more black people than white people. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. But listen to this. I mean, this is every agency of the federal government now has to be woke by executive order. How about this? This is part of it, too. Headline. This is from, I think, the Wall Street Journal. Biden's latest whack at the suburbs will change your neighborhood for the worst. The goal of fair housing would seem to be quite straightforward, as spelled out in the Fair Housing Act of 1968. It precludes discrimination, sale, rental, or financing of dwellings based on race, color, national origin, religion, sex, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Okay. But for the Biden administration's Department of Housing and Urban Development, fair housing is much more. In proposed regulations that would touch any jurisdiction that accepts any sort of HUD funding, which is everyone, every county, every city, fair housing must mean a plan to, quote, promote equity in their communities, decrease segregation, and increase access to opportunity and community assets for people of color and other underserved communities. Now, translated, that means that the route to upward mobility for disadvantaged minorities lies through their relocation to more affluent communities where they no longer will be underserved. So now, if you take money from the federal government, you have to bring more underserved minorities into the suburbs from the cities. This sounds more like a political thing to get more Democrats into the suburbs, which tend to vote Republican. I don't know. So it's being interpreted here. This is all part of that executive order. That equity would mean anything from building low-income housing to redrawing school district lines for racial or socioeconomic integration. All as assessed by the HUD bureaucracy. I tell you, this administration is trying to bring socialism and communism and God knows what else to us. Unbelievable. What else do we have here? The alliances of the apocalypse have been set and formed now. Right now, we've pushed Russia and China together now. They are forming an alliance. There's three superpowers in the world, the United States, China, and Russia. And now two of them have joined together to oppose the one. How do you think this is going to work out for the United States? Due to the endless bumbling and warmongering of the Biden administration, China and Russia have now been pushed into each other's arms. And they have the ability to do whatever they want. This is really big, and this was underreported this week. I don't, by the way, you know, lots of nuclear weapons involved here. So China's joining Russia. We're going to provide them with weapons to fight Ukraine. NATO now is providing weapons and an unlimited amount of funds, mainly yours and mine, to Ukraine. They're pushing us to World War III. This is what they want. Where's the environmentalist? Thermonuclear war isn't good for global warming, I don't think. Talk about climate change. You want to talk about climate change over New York City when a 50 megaton nuclear weapon goes off? Paul, you start building your fallout shelter yet? You really should.
I'm going to start.
We also start building. How would you like to live in New York City? How would you like to go to work in New York City? You know, this is so underreported. Russia's coming out. Putin's coming out and saying he's going to use nukes. Meanwhile, we have the United States coming out and saying that we're going to defeat Russia. In Ukraine. No, we're not. Russia is not going to be defeated in Ukraine. They're not. They got nuclear weapons. You think they're going to allow themselves to be defeated? They're not. And they're trying to tell you that they're losing. Ukraine is nothing but a meat grinder. And you know what's going to happen with Ukraine? Either we're going to go to nuclear war over this, or more than likely, what's going to happen is the war is going to go on with more weapons, and more Ukrainians are going to die, military and civilian, and a bunch of Russians are going to die too. And hopefully, ultimately, after all these needless deaths, there'll be some kind of negotiated settlement. But I've never seen in my lifetime such talk of nuclear war, outward talk. I mean, I've never heard leader of Russia actually threaten using nuclear weapons. Do you think Putin is threatening and he wouldn't do it if his back was against the wall? Meanwhile, you know, Biden flies out to Ukraine, look like a leader, right? And he comes out and says, we're going to be involved as long as it takes to win the war against Russia. Russia's now pulling all their forces together for a spring offensive. And if Russia wanted to take over Ukraine, they could have done it. They could have done it day one. They restrained themselves and tried. Their goal was to liberate the Donbas region, the eastern area, the Russian speaking part of Ukraine. That's historically been part of Russia. That was their goal because they didn't want NATO up against them. Up against their border. And that's what's going to happen. This is a way, if there's going to be a negotiated settlement to this, Russia's getting part of Ukraine. It's going to happen because they're not going to just go back to the previous borders and say, okay, you know, that's our negotiation. We're going to just lose. That's not going to happen. Hopefully, that's going to be the end of this. But right now, there's no peace negotiations. There aren't any scheduled. Both sides are expecting the other side to back down at some point. And how long is it going to be until we hit the point of no return? During Biden's visit, he announced even more aid to Ukraine. By some, U.S. has given $196 billion in total, military, financial, humanitarian aid. Do you know we bailed out their pension system? Our pensions are failing here in the United States. We bailed out the Ukrainian pension system. How is that in our military interest? I don't know. How much more are we going to give them in the coming year? And we, by far, the United States, by multiples, have given more aid to Ukraine than anyone else. And we have, and we've been depleting our own munitions. Generals are coming out and saying, wait a second, we don't have much left. But this is our war now. I mean, we've gone into this now. The point of no return is here. The question is, how does this thing end? And it's either going to end through nuclear exchange or it's going to end through some kind of negotiation after millions of people die. Russia's ready to bring hundreds of thousands of new troops in. They're building large field hospitals near the Ukrainian border, just like they did prior to the original invasion. And right now, the Russians are playing for keeps. And I believe that the Russians are going to formally declare war on Ukraine and they're not going to be playing nice anymore. But the Ukrainians and Zelensky, who this guy's a really bad guy, I'm going to tell you. You know, meanwhile, our leaders come out and say, we're defending democracy. Ukraine isn't a democracy. There's a one-party rule there right now. You know, Zelensky's a dictator. There's no freedom of the press. There's no freedom of speech. God knows where these billions and billions of dollars are going. I'll tell you where it's going. How much of it's being kicked back to politicians here in the United States, rhinos and Democrats and the big guy. And what if, I should say what if, this is what I believe, all the dealings that the Biden family have had in Ukraine, all the crimes that were committed there, all the influencing peddling, do you don't think that Zelensky would tell Biden, look, you do everything we tell you to do with this war, or we're going to expose you and your family to all the crimes that you committed in our country, all the money you've taken? How about that? And if that was the case, imagine that, that nuclear war happened because of a corrupt election here. And because of a compromised president, who is corrupt. Wow. So, Kiev's National Security and Defense Council boss, I'm not going to try to say his name, called Vladimir Putin Hitler's twin. And he reiterated Ukraine's ambition to expel all Russian troops from its soil, including from Crimea, which it annexed, Moscow annexed in 2014. I don't know what kind of fantasy world this guy's living in, but that's not going to happen. Russians will use nukes before that happens. And like I said, they're saying it. Russia is actually coming out and saying it. If we're pushed against the wall, we will use our nuclear arsenal. It's insanity. Oh, and by the way, I didn't talk about this last week. You know, Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize winning past New York Times God reporter, came out with an article saying that his sources say that the United States bombed the Nord Stream pipeline. Oh, tell us something that we don't know already. No, we're denying it. But he stands by it. He says he's got a high-ranking official. He stands by it. He knows it, and he does know it. And the thing about that is, A, it's an act of war, bombing a country's pipeline. Number two, it's an actual act of war against our allies in Germany and elsewhere that depend on that oil. So why would we do that? Well, we would do it because we don't want Germany saying, well, we have to negotiate with Russia and end this thing because they're going to turn off our gas. Well, it's already turned off. Now there's nothing to negotiate. More and more is going to come out about this. That would make us one of the biggest, the biggest terrorist country in the world. Or at least we're at war with Russia. It's insanity. Someone's finally starting to get a little bit of common sense. After meetings this week in Brussels with NATO military partners, Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley was interviewed by the Financial Times, discussing his vision for the potential endgame in Ukraine. In his view, he said, neither side is likely to prevail in what will be a protracted conflict, eventually ending in negotiations. It will be almost impossible for the Russians to achieve their political objectives by military means, he said. It is unlikely that Russia is going to overrun Ukraine. It's just not going to happen. But he also conceded that it'll be very, very difficult for Ukraine this year to kick the Russians out of every inch of territory now captured. So it's not going to happen. So the problem is, you know, at what point here are people going to say, you know what, there's enough killing going on. Nobody's going to win this thing. World War III is not a good thing. Thermonuclear war, probably something we should try to avoid. What else is going on? Oh, this is the biggest thing this week. All right. This is the biggest thing this week. Do you know that the World Health Organization is now signing a treaty, and 194 member nations are going to sign this legally binding treaty, giving the World Health Organization the authority to declare pandemics and submits member countries to, quote, the central role of the WHO as the directing and coordinating authority on international health work in areas of, like, lockdowns, treatments, medical supply chain, surveillance, and disinformation and false news once a pandemic is declared. You know what this means? We've given up the sovereignty of the United States of America to the world government. This is all part of it. So the head of the WHO could just basically declare that every American will be forced to be vaccinated. The head of the WHO could tell everybody in the world to shut down. And we'd have to abide by it. This is outrageous. I'm not hearing a whole lot about people about this. It's not being reported by the mainstream media, of course, because I guess they like one world government. Now, some Republican senators are pushing back with an effort to reinforce congressional power to authorize treaties. Now, you have a treaty. It's supposed to be approved by the Senate, two-thirds of the Senate, 67%. But they know that. See, the WHO knew that. The draft accord, which will be legally binding on all 194 member nations, gives the WHO, like I said, the authority to declare everything regarding health. 17 senators, led by Ron Johnson, introduced the No WHO Pandemic Preparedness Treaty Without Senate Approval Act, which states that the pandemic accord must be deemed a treaty, thus requiring the consent of a supermajority of the Senate. So they're presenting their zero draft of the accord, negotiated with the help of U.S. Health and Human Secretary Xavier Becerra, to all member nations on February 27th, tomorrow, to agree to final terms. The WHO failed miserably in this COVID pandemic. They were wrong about everything. About masks, about lockdowns, about everything. And we're going to give them the power at the expense of American sovereignty, where they're going to tell us what to do. And Biden's going to sign it. Now, some doubt that this bill, even if approved, will stop the World Health Organization accord from going into effect once President Biden signs it. Quote, with all due respect to the sponsoring senators, that will not do the trick. Francis Boyle, professor of international law at Illinois University, told the Epoch Times. The reason, he said, is that the WHO accord is drafted specifically to circumvent the Senate approval process, and Congress instead should immediately withhold its yearly contributions to the WHO and take the United States out of the organization. Of course, the United States is the largest contributor to the WHO's $6.72 billion budget. But the way it's worded, it'll come into force immediately, provisionally, unless the Senate somehow overrides it. So immediately after it's signed, it's in effect. So if we have another pandemic in the next couple of months or something, they're going to do whatever they want, and we can't do anything. It's just unbelievable. How could a country like us sign away our ability to make our own decisions? This is all part of control. They're going to be able to control everything, include forcing populations to take newly developed vaccines, preventing doctors from prescribing non-vaccine treatments or medicines like ivermectin. And they're going to have control. This one guy, the head of the WHO, Director General Tedros, this guy is going to have power over your doctor to tell you what he can prescribe you. And it's a total circumvention of the American Constitution. I tell you, they're not telling you about it. The media is not reporting it because they don't want you to know about it because they know you'll be outraged. I'm going to follow this very, very closely because this is another part of the one world government to reset the control. What other outrageous things are going on now? Geez, I don't have enough time to cover them. I'm going to have to briefly cover them. You know, we're living in a time of evil. We're living in a time of good versus evil. I think most of us would agree to that, that these are not usual times, the things that we're seeing. How about, did you see the video, Paul, of that big student attacking the teacher in the school and beating the crap out of him?
No, I didn't.
Oh, this gigantic 200-pound guy or whatever. He just runs and tackles and slams the it's an aide to the teacher, a small woman, down face first into the floor, and then proceeds to beat the living crap out until people are pulling off, kicking it. I mean, she's not moving. She's unconscious. This is what people are doing. Kids beating each other. Listen to this headline. 17-year-old honor student, soccer player, shot and killed by 13 and 14-year-old boys. He offered to drive home in sub-zero temperatures. So he pulls over, he sees these two kids walking, and it's freezing out. So he's being a good human being, and he pulls over, and he offers to give him a ride. And they try to carjack his car, and he resists, and they kill him. I mean, these are young kids. How do you see this? And you see it over and over again. These kids fighting. It's right here in Central Region. What happened to that poor girl, right? She was beat up, right? And she winds up killing herself because now it's not bad enough that you're humiliated in the school. Now they film it and it's on Facebook and it's on social media everywhere and your humiliation continues in perpetuity. Think about it. When you were a kid, all right, you know, you had an altercation with somebody in school, all right, you know, it was limited to that classroom or something, you know. Now it's all over the place. And the more vicious it is, the more popular the video will be on Facebook. Or wherever else they put it. This is a failure on so many different levels. This is happening here. It's a failure of our education system where these things are happening in schools. It's a failure of parenting. What other outrageous stuff is going on? I just can't believe some of the things I read. A Canadian man convicted of raping a 3-month-old infant has been transferred to a prison with a unit for mothers to take care of their babies after claiming to be a transgender. So this child rapist, not even a child, infant rapist, all of a sudden claims to be trans. You could just claim this out of like on a spur of the moment, and all of a sudden your rights kick in, right? He didn't identify as a woman until he went to prison. He raped a baby boy in 1997 when he was a 15-year-old babysitter. The infant was so severely injured that he had to be airlifted to a hospital to get reconstructive surgery. And there's other things in this guy's past that's horrible. So he says, okay, now I identify as a girl. So now he goes to this woman's prison. And in this prison, women who have little babies can take care of them in the prison. And this is where this guy's going to be. Because he's transgender. How about this? This was yesterday. Los Angeles District Attorney George Gascon suspended a prosecutor for misgendering and deadnaming a convicted child molester accused of murder who started identifying as a woman after being arrested. Deadnaming, whatever that is. It's not using their new name, just using their birth name or whatever. And what's ironic about this is 8 years ago, Gascon's office refused to prosecute the individual, Hannah Tubbs, as an adult after he molested a 10-year-old girl just 2 weeks before his 18th birthday. So Tubbs, now 26, who went by the name of James at the time of the molestation, he's accused of sexually molesting a 4-year-old girl at a California library. Early last year, Tubbs was sentenced to 2 years in a juvenile facility for girls. So the prosecutor that's now trying to prosecute him didn't honor his gender and pronouns and stuff. So the DA is suspending him. So this guy's a victim now. And I can go on and on. I didn't even get the outrageous stuff that's going on here. It's just nuts. I'm going to open next week's show with just the outrageous stuff. Maybe. I don't know. Because I don't get to it all. Insane world we're living in, people. And unfortunately, I got to bring it to you here each and every week because you're not going to hear it elsewhere. Thanks so much for joining us. Remember the website, thefinancialphysician.com, where the podcast of this entire show is right after the program. My email, lou@thefinancialphysician.com. My office number, if you want to make an income tax appointment or come in for a complimentary financial review, 732-905-8100. Remember, I'm not far right. I'm just right so far. Have a good week.